be in the House Labor and Commerce Committee at approximately 3:30 on March 24th, 1999. For the record, present are Chairman Rutherford, Vice Chairman Halcrow, Representative Sanders, Murkowski, Harris, and Assistant. Welcome, committee members. On the agenda today, we have a waiver of House Bill 40, HB 121, Dental Care Insurance, and then initial public hearing on 143, the real estate bill. Be my intention to discuss the waiver issue first, very briefly, finish public testimony. We have a few folks that want to testify on 121, and then open for discussion on 121. There are people available for questions on that bill. And then hopefully take initial public testimony on 143, the real estate bill. It would not be my intention to move the real estate bill today. I just would like to take some public testimony and alert the committee to the existence of the bill, and it's a wake-up call to the real estate industry that the bill is in the House. But with that, I have in hand a sheet requesting a waiver from committee of House Bill 40. That's the Department of the Consolidation of the Department of Community and Regional Affairs with the Department of Community and Commerce and Economic Development, which is not quite right here. Department of Community and Economic Development. Oh, that's the title of the bill.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, right.
I've been requested by the leadership of the House because of and the bill has had a hearing in the CRNA, and that bill is moved out. Is that right?
No, Mr. Chair. The bill is scheduled for a second hearing tomorrow morning.
So it'll be your intention. This is a waiver pending referral, as much as I will be out of town on Friday. If the committee wants to give its consent to waive the bill. This is a consolidation bill. The bill basically was written by this committee last year, and there's a desire on the part of the leadership to move the bill to the House Finance Committee, where I understand the governor is going to lay out his proposal on consolidation and work the bill there in finance. So actually, this is a blessing in disguise. It's a major undertaking. The bill's like 60 or 80 pages long. I don't think that we're absolving our statutory authority on the area, and I would ask that if everybody agree to a waiver. It will avoid a lot of work for us, and the work will, we would sit in here and sift the bill, and then it would be changed in the Finance Committee anyway. Why do that?
We could just waive them all.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
President Halcrow.
Thank you. I have some uneasiness about doing that before I see what happens in community regional affairs. We just, as a matter of fact, before I came out of the door to come down here, we got the fiscal note from the administration, and there are some concerns, members of my committee on labor and commerce. There isn't any rural members that sit on this committee, and there are some concerns, especially how they feel that last year the bill didn't make it to DC and our community regional affairs. So I know I have two other committee members on this committee that sit with me on community regional affairs, and I can't sign that until I see what comes out of community regional affairs.
Well, it's really your responsibility to read the waiver across the floor on Friday, so get it straightened out.
Okay. Well,
with that, I'll circulate the waiver.
Mr. Chairman.
Right, there is a problem because we don't meet by the time it's supposed to be ejected from your committee, and the Finance Committee has its calendar. So.
I understand that, but if something happens in my committee and something comes up after it leaves, I want to make sure. I feel this is a little premature before I see what comes out of my committee. And I've made some commitments. I mean, I have assured members of my committee that know, their concerns and considerations would be taken into consideration.
I'm sure you will, as a chairman. I would expect that for the two co-chairs here on the table. So.
Chairman, I think.
President Harris.
Thank you. I don't have any problem waiving it out of this committee. We have control of it in our committee.
Right.
And if, in fact, we're not happy with it, we won't bring it out of our committee to this committee. So I think it's been fairly well documented. This committee had it in here for 6 weeks or so last year and basically ended up writing it again. And that's what we have in front of us. So I don't have any problem. The three of us will have gone, at least on this committee, will have seen this bill
anyway,
one side and down the other. So once it leaves our committee, it will have at least three members here that will have seen it. And if it's not a problem with the chairman here, I don't have any problem with waiving it out of this committee, since we will have control of it anyway.
I would think that's a good idea, and I would recommend the co-chairs of CNRA speak to leadership about this issue so you have a full appraisal of what's happening. Marching system.
I personally would not want to sign to waive it. I think that maybe the committee last year looked at it, but I haven't, and I would like to look at it.
Okay. No, I didn't need to. I'm not going to put it in the form of a motion. President Bryce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you. I think we've had the discussion last year. My stance is pretty much the same. We're making small government big and schizophrenic at the same time, to use a term of art that is probably applicable. And I just don't support the concept or the bill. Nothing against the intentions of the sponsor. And so, of course, I wouldn't want to sign it or to ask to move it on just for the simple fact that I don't think it's appropriate business, period.
Well, it's been the position of the chair. I normally wouldn't waive a bill if we'd have people objecting to it.
I know. Very good about that, yes.
On the other hand, as I understand it, the leadership has talked to the governor, and the governor basically, as I was told, wants to have it recast in the finance committee. So.
Yeah.
Well, you're going.
Right.
Nobody from the third floor has contacted me.
Very good.
Which is what's new.
So what's it take to get this out of here?
I understand. No, it's the pleasure of the chair, and I committed to moving doing what I could to satisfy the concerns of the members of the committee, and if the members of the committee don't want to waive it, that's their prerogative. I'm going to leave this project in the hands of Vice Chairman Halco, because I will be in Anchorage the next 2 days and not be available to shepherd this. So if you'd talk to the speaker about it, I'd appreciate it.
Okay.
And we'll hold off and I'll rely on Reps and Halco to coordinate with the leadership and see what is to be done. It's my understanding that the rule of the chair is the official rule in this case. There's nothing in the House rules that require a majority or a full unanimous consent on waiver. But it's been my ruling that I wouldn't want to override the wishes of the unanimous members of the committee unless I was a personal delinquent.
If it was a personal bill of yours, Mr. Chair, I'm sure our views would be much different.
I would hope so, sir. Representative Bryce, yes, sir. Well, with that, we'll move on with our calendar business. I'd like to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 121, and which is the dental insurance bill. And with that, and there was a couple folks signed up for questions here, and I think that there are some folks in the Anchorage LIO that wish to testify on 121. First, I'd like to take the testimony from Rose Calamarides. Ms. Calamarides, are you available?
Chairman Roberts, thank you.
First, Ms. Calamarides, excuse me, I would like to apologize for what happened to you last meeting. I, through an inadvertency, In the communicator myself, you were inadvertently cut off, and I do apologize for that.
That's no problem, no offense taken. I'm the administrator of the Alaska Teamster Trust Fund, and the trust funds, while they are not impacted by this legislation, we oppose the legislation. This fund represents more than 100 employers and more than 8,000 covered lives, and we understand that when small employers cannot afford to buy insurance to cover dental expenses, then the unpaid costs often shift to employers like those in our plan. I'm not aware of any dental PPOs in Alaska. However, they are negotiating such arrangements in the lower 48, and it creates a very strong competitive marketplace. Dentists who choose to participate in these PPOs are selling their services at lower prices in exchange for some assurance by employers that they will get more patient traffic. Those who have not agreed to participate are seeing their patients go to the preferred group of doctors. Therefore, I understand why some Alaskan dentists are afraid of PPOs. According to a Daily News article just last year, dentists in Alaska enjoy the distinction of being the highest paid professionals in the state. If I were in their shoes, I wouldn't want to lose that distinction either. We understand why they are seeking protection from competition, why they are attempting to regulate their industry here in Alaska. However, we must oppose it, because ultimately those who compete in Florida will pay for the protection. I heard testimony last week advocating that this legislation would protect small businesses, and I think it was directed at dentists as being small business people. And that's certainly true, that this would protect them, but it would be at the expense of other small business people. Insurance companies are not going to pay the extra cost. I think the sponsor bill made a reference that the insurance companies would be paying this, but the insurance companies are not going to pay the extra cost for this. When a small business person goes to the marketplace to buy insurance, the insurance company sells them insurance based on the cost experience in that marketplace. So if they were buying an insurance product with a PPO, it's going to be their premium's going to be less than it would be without a PPO. And if this proposed legislation is passed, then providers are not going to negotiate into PPOs because there's no assurance then that they would get the volume. It's a real simple concept: discounted rates for volume referral. By creating regulations which do not permit employers to negotiate lower health care costs, then you directly impact their ability to compete with other Alaskan companies who do not provide insurance or outside companies who enjoy lower health care costs. What happens then is the Alaskan company must shift the cost to their employees, and in the end, the patient pays for this protection bestowed on them. Or when the insured patient does not or cannot pay, the provider simply shifts the cost to plans who are paying. If you pass this legislation, then small employers who have no choice but to buy insured products will not have the cost benefit of these preferred arrangements. Our membership task force, by the way, and these are rank and file members, looked at this legislation, and they quickly recognized that this was simply a cost shift from the patient's pocket to the doctor's pocket. Please keep in mind that Alaskans pay more for medical costs than in any other state, and the only way we can keep costs down is by negotiating preferred arrangements. Please do not regulate this industry and preclude the opportunity for competition among healthcare providers. I want to quote Henry Aaron again, and I've done that in the past at similar hearings, because Henry Aaron of the Brookings Institute put it best when he said, this legislation is not about consumer choice or consumer protection. It is, quote, meant to prevent the impairment of doctors' income. And in closing, please remember that the support for this bill has come from doctors. The patients or consumers are eerily absent, and of course the employers oppose it. So thank you very much for your time, and thanks for the extra time too.
Thank you very much, Ms. Comrades. There are questions of the witness. And, thank you very much. Next we'd like to go to Dr. Thomas Hipscher. Mr. Hipscher, did you not testify at our last meeting, sir?
I did not. I testified on HB 300 last year, but I have not testified on this yet.
Oh, okay. But we do have, for members of the committee, we have a letter from Dr. Hipscher of March 24th that's pointed out. And doctor, could you identify yourself formally and your affiliation for the record, please, and please give us your testimony.
Yes, my name is Dr. Tom Hipscher. I'm a general dentist in Anchorage. First of all, I would like to say that the Alaska Dental Society and most of the dentists in Alaska are not anti-PPO or anti-HMO. They are pro-patient. That's what this bill is all about. In response to some issues that were brought up in the public hearing on HB 121 last Friday, I would like to offer the following statements. Dentistry versus medicine. Everyone in the insurance industry categorizes dentistry the same as medicine, when in fact they are very different. Here are the differences. Medicine is reactive, whereas dentistry is preventive. In medicine, there are a high number of specialists, a low number of generalists, whereas in dentistry, just the opposite. In medicine, we see a high number of catastrophic incidents, whereas in dentistry, we rarely ever see catastrophic claims. Does medicine meet the criteria for insured risk? Absolutely. Does dentistry meet the criteria for an insured risk? Absolutely not. The average claim amount for medicine is usually high, whereas with medicine, it is normally, or with dentistry, it is usually low, whereas with medicine, it's usually quite high. Dentistry has done an excellent job with prevention and education to minimize oral disease. Cavity rates in children have been reduced significantly over the years, and more older people than ever still have their teeth. Insurers say they will lose control, patient control, if HB 121 passes. Insurers will not lose patient control. Patients will not leave PPOs and HMOs in droves as a result of passage of this bill. There is a financial disincentive for patients to leave their PPOs and HMOs because when they see a non-participating provider, they will have to make up the difference between what the insurance company pays and what the provider charges. If many people elect to leave their PPO and HMO and are willing to pay the difference, then there is something fundamentally wrong with the PPO or the HMO. It should be the patient's choice as to whether or not they want to spend their own money to see another provider. Insurers also say they will not be able to guarantee participating providers adequate numbers of patients if this bill passes. The truth of the matter is that of all of the contracts that I have seen inviting me to join a PPO or HMO, not a single one has mentioned, let alone guaranteed, any patients as a condition of my signing a PPO or HMO contract. I'm sure that if you ask any provider, you will find the same is true with them. The insurance industry is simply not telling the truth about this matter. Insurers say they will not be able to attract providers to join their PPOs and HMOs. Dentistry is a very competitive business, and many providers spend $2,000 to $3,000 a month on advertising in an effort to attract patients. There are those that will join a PPO and HMO for free advertising it provides in exchange for reduced fees. In the case of United Concordia in Alaska, not a single dentist joined their PPO because their initial fee schedule was far too low for Alaska standards. What they simply did was raise their fee schedules, and they had a drove of dentists join. And the cost of providing dental care in Alaska is extremely high, and as businessmen, we must make a profit in order to stay in business, the same as any other business. A couple of other major points I'd like to say. The insurance industry has convinced employers and legislatures that HB 121 and HB 300 is any wrong provider legislation. I prepared a detailed explanation comparing those two pieces of legislation. The comparison is included in your packet of letters. I ask that you carefully review this comparison to see that HB 129 is not one or any willing provider legislation. One other thing, patient testimony. It was alluded to that when HB 300 was introduced last year in a public hearing, patients did not show up to testify. It is likely they won't show up to testify for HB 121 as well. Patients are intimidated by the process and fear retaliation by their insurance companies. Just as patients rely on providers to sort out the mess that occurs with dental claims, they rely on their providers to carry out the message to the legislature. Patients don't live in a political world. As such, they feel uncomfortable and asked to speak up about problems they are faced with their insurance. Therefore, who else will stand up for them if not their providers? And for employers, if employers listen, Since dental care does not meet the criteria as insured is, there are several other alternatives that employers can pursue that will allow employees complete freedom of choice, freedom to have the dental care they need without interference from a third party, and save money at the same time. If employers would only take the time to listen, there is a lot to be learned about this matter, and the Teamsters are a great situation with this. They can contact the American Dental Association and learn how they can be, how they can provide a dental benefit plan that provides dental care at a lower cost than that which can be purchased from an insurance company. That's really all I have to say. Thank you.
Questions of Dr. Hitchman. And I would point out for the committee that in your packet is a letter dated March 17th from the doctor, as well as one that was included today dated March 24th. And I believe that that's what he refers to as the analysis regarding any willing provider. With that, Representative Murkowski, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's specifically where I am going with my question. I have had conversations with people on both sides of this issue and am getting conflicting information, if you will, as to whether or not HB 121 is any willing provider. You have stated that it is not, and in your letter you dedicate 2 pages to, I guess, the differences to it. And I guess I'm still not there. As I understand it, if I choose to go to a dentist who is not on a preferred provider list, I can do so, and I would pay basically the difference, whatever that percentage is. How does this take my dentist out of the any willing provider category? Or am I making my question clear?
Yes, very clear.
Thank you.
The main distinction between any willing provider legislation and this legislation is that with any willing provider legislation, any dentist can join a PPO. All they have to do is say, I want to join your PPO, and they are in. Normally, providers are invited to join a PPO so that they limit the number of providers that are allowed in the PPO. That way, with the plans that they have sold and the numbers of employees that purchased or that are in that plan, those people are directed to the PPO providers. So if you have any willing provider legislation which allows any dentist to join a PPO plan, then what you're doing is diluting the numbers of doctors, you know, the small numbers of doctors. So, you know, in effect, they're destroying the PPO. This legislation, on the other hand, allows PPOs to exist. And in fact, we have no problem with PPOs existing as long as the patient obtains care that matches their needs and to their satisfaction. That's fine with us. With this legislation, the PPO still exists. The doctors are invited to join the PPO. Not any doctor can join that PPO. The only thing that we're saying is that if a patient goes to a PPO doctor or doctors and they are dissatisfied with the care that they receive because they feel like they're being run in and out of an office, then they should be able to take their benefit with them and get the care that they feel is appropriate to their needs and have that care paid for at least to the same extent that they would have received under the PPO. Is there a financial disincentive for them to do that? Absolutely. You know, I have patients in my practice that have left to go, you know, they've left my practice to go to PPOs and they've subsequently returned because they weren't receiving the level of care that I provide them. And it's an open door policy, you know. If it's their choice who they want to see. Does that clear it up for you?
Well, it helps. I'm not I'm not entirely clear, but I'll keep listening.
Now, the main distinction is in any line provider legislation, any doctor can join the PPO, which dilutes the number of patients that the doctors can see, okay? Whereas with a true PPO, there may be only a few doctors, and there may be a wealth of patients. So those wealth of patients are funneled into those few doctors. So the few doctors are seeing many, many patients in exchange for the reduced fees. So, whereas in the other situation, it's just the opposite.
Is there any way I can add to that, Ms. Murkowski? I don't know if that's appropriate. I'm not sure what the protocol is here. This is Rose Calamaritis.
This is the chairman. Ms. Calamaritis, if you have a statement, you can bring it to my attention, but I'll give you an opportunity in a moment.
Okay.
I just want to clarify one thing, Dr. This is the chairman. I would take exception to your definition of any willing provider. It's my understanding any willing provider legislation, and as a matter of fact, I've even introduced a bill on that in my past youthful years, provides that a patient may choose anybody they wish to choose, and the insurer has to pay the same reimbursable rate no matter what physician or provider is chosen. Now, that's the any willing provider. So I think you may be mischaracterizing, and I don't want to, this is a complicated enough issue, and I want to confuse my committee members. I mean, would you agree with my statement, Doctor?
I agree with that in part. You know, I agree with mine as well.
Oh. Representative Falco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hipscher, thank you for your testimony and your letter. Let me ask you, in your opinion, will House Bill 121 increase the cost of providing coverage by small business employers?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions, Doctor? Doc, you're not getting off that easy. This is the chairman again. I really appreciate your efforts in writing these letters to the committee and trying to help us understand the issues. I suspect, though, that we may have some problems. I refer to your letter of the 24th.
Okay.
And I'm looking at paragraph 5, the fee differentials. I'm going to see if I can understand that. Let me read this aloud here. Federal law says the dentist cannot charge uninsured patients at a different rate than an insured patient. What federal law are you referring to?
I don't have the number exactly, but, you know, we cannot, for the purpose of charging patients, make up a difference because an insurance plan may pay at a lower rate. And so we balance bill our normal patients for the difference.
In other words,
that's neither ethical nor is it legal to do that.
Well, in other words, you can't charge less for somebody that has less money, though, for a procedure, or what?
It means that if I enter into an agreement with a PPO and I charge, you know, say 30% or 70% of my normal fees, then I cannot charge my normal patients the difference, you know, and increase those fees to make up the difference.
Well, you can't have a two-tier fee schedule because of federal law.
Yeah,
that doesn't sound right. Are you sure?
That's as far as I am concerned. It has been.
So if you sign, what's your
federal law? But,
your testimony,
you know,
is
from an ethical standpoint, Mr. Chairman, we can't do that.
Really? Because if you joined a PPO, agreed to charge 75% of customary and normal your fee schedule, and you had a non-PPO patient walking the door, you can charge them 100%?
I do charge much 100%. As a matter of fact, I should probably charge the PPO 100%, and then I have to indicate that as a discount on my accounting as a 30% discount or a 25% discount to the PPO person. And that may or may not have tax implications to that patient, because that is actually a forgiveness of debt.
Well, let's depart that without getting confused with federal law here. I suspect that you go on to say that HB 121 is asking that the same rules of fairness apply to the insurance company regarding reimbursement, same level. This means that the patient should be entitled to the same reimbursement level for a given procedure regardless of the provider that renders the treatment. Differential reimbursement to a patient based on their choice of provider is a monetary penalty imposed on the patient for exercising their choice of provider. So that is the basically the rationale for in the bill, subsection C1, where it says the health care insurer may not directly or indirectly reimburse a covered person at a different rate because of the person's choice of a dentist.
All I'm saying is that if a person elects to go to they are penalized monetarily for doing that because normally the PPO will either pay nothing for that procedure or they will pay a substantially reduced rate for that procedure.
Right, but that would be either a PPO or a point of service option.
Correct.
Now, Dr. Hipscher, is that, am I pronouncing your name right?
That's correct.
Right. We have a legal opinion from our legislative counsel, Mr. Ford, that indicates that, well, as written, House Bill 121 precludes, and I draw the committee's attention to this opinion, it's really quite important you have it on your file. Well, it doesn't preclude offering a point of service option or using a provider, preferred provider type of coverage. It fundamentally destroys any financial incentive to do so. So the constructive effect is that it would prohibit the establishment of new PPOs or point of service option type plans. I mean, basically, so you can make the argument that what the bill does is mandate a constructive fee-for-service only type menu available to the small business and individuals of the state of Alaska. I mean, would you disagree with my statement, or
I would disagree with your statement, Mr. Chairman. Why can't a PPO still exist, and why can't doctors still negotiate with insurers?
Well, because correct me if I'm wrong. Usually on a PPO, it's the they agree to be reimbursed at a lower rate. Representative Bundy, please join the want to join us on the table. Reimburse the dentist that's part of the panel at a contracted lower rate than they might otherwise. Is that not true?
Mr. Chairman, can I help muddy the waters?
Certainly, Representative Bundy. Sir.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, the reduced rate is for volume of service. So someone who's in a PPO says, I'll do preparation X for 70% of the actual cost and make it up in volume because they must obviously at some point pay 100% of their expenses or they're not going to be in business. So they make it up in volume. Now, patient wants to go to another dentist. They still only get paid that 70%. The other dentist, not mean in the PPO, needs 100%, so that patient has to copay 30% to achieve the same level of cost with the dentist who's out of the program as compared to the dentist who's in the PPO that'll do the procedure for 70% of the cost.
Or in the alternative, there's a actual penalty on the copayment if you step outside the panel.
Well, it's the patient's choice, but that penalty is...
Well, instead of getting the 70% reimbursement, they more typically might get 50 or 60%.
And that is the financial disincentive for a patient to have choice.
That's correct. Would that be a correct analysis of a typical PPO, doctor?
That is exactly the way it works.
In your experience in the marketplace, having dealt with some of these folks, what type of a percentage differential is between what they would pay inside of a panel and they discount going out for penalty, further penalty? Do you have any idea on that?
Well, I just had a patient that I had hoped would testify that actually was a member of, well, she's a foster parent and has children that are covered under an Aetna HMO, and because she brought her children to me as a new foster parent, they actually paid absolutely nothing on her claim. The children were also covered under state Medicaid because of the foster parent situation, and the Medicaid denied the claim as well because the foster parent failed to take advantage of all of the insurance benefits available to them. So here a patient is left holding the entire bill for a mandated, she was mandated to have those kids in to see their doctor and dentist within 30 days of her taking over the foster care. So that's the extreme. The average is probably 15 to 20% lower than what the normal PPO fees would be.
So to use Representative Bundy's example of 70% reimbursement of a procedure, and you stepped out, there'd be like a further 20% discount against the 70%. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
And it varies all over the point, all over the place.
And doctor, for your information, we endeavored to contact the patient that was going to be a witness.
Yes.
And they didn't get back to us. We were prepared to set up an off-net type of a phone hookup, but unfortunately, we never made the connection.
No, she was here last Friday to testify and was totally intimidated because she didn't find anybody to help her learn how to do this. So, I apologize for her not being able to testify.
Well, that's a shame. We would have appreciated her testimony, and I appreciate your inviting her.
She she was going to write written testimony to you, Mr. Chairman.
And Dr. Hesper, I am quite concerned that about the provisions in the bill with the same prohibition on rate differential on the reimbursement. I guess that's my biggest heartburn with the bill right now, because according to Mr. Ford's memorandum, he sees, and I agree with him, that there is absolutely no incentive to establish PPOs or point of service type programs in the state if this bill were to pass. And as a result of that, I asked Dr. Logan when he was testifying in our last hearing whether you thought the Dental Society and your organization would agree to modifying the bill to provide for at least the point of service option provision. And if we did that, I think in order to make it equitable, we perhaps would have to put a floor on the rate differential that they'd be allowed to to reimburse at. In other words, you would allow the choice of the patient to step out of a panel under a PPO, but they would be reimbursed at, say, a 10 or 15% less as a maximum differential. And that way they'd have the choice, and it would minimize the reimbursement to the other members of your profession. He did not seem particularly excited about that prospect. Do you have an opinion on that?
I wouldn't seem particularly excited about it either, Mr. Chairman. I think it's kind of a moot point, from our perspective, because I don't think you're going to see patients leaving HMOs and PPOs and droves because of that situation.
Well, we don't have any HMOs in the state.
Well, a dental and health maintenance organization. That's not to say that, at some point in time there won't be some here.
Not with the legislation passed in this legislature. Representative Bundy.
Mr. Chairman, on this point, I'd like to respectfully disagree with my attorney, which is a very dangerous thing, but Mr. Ford said there's no financial incentive for the PPO, but I disagree. There is the financial incentive of volume. Everyone tells me that volume will allow dentists then to operate at lower costs. So again, using my analogy, got PPOs, they're doing a procedure for 70% of what it would cost on the market. Someone leaves that PPO, goes to another dentist, they are going to pay 100% of what that procedure costs. The insurance company will pay 70% and the patient will pay the additional 30%. So I still see a financial incentive for people where money is the main question, staying within the PPO. if because they have a close personal relationship with a doctor, because they think he's a specialist, because of whatever choice they make, they want to go outside the program, they will pay a financial penalty to go outside the program. So that means to me that there is a financial incentive for people to stay in the program.
No, but if you had a point of service option, it would be programmed right into the program. So the employee patient would have the ability to make the choice out of the get-go, with the understanding that he would have to pay either a higher premium or pay a greater copayment. That's the beauty of a point of service option.
I'm saying that already exists. Well, if this bill were to pass intact, that's the way it would exist.
Well, what's going to happen, I suggest the economics of the situation, Representative Bundy, is that because of the equality of reimbursement, there will not be the formation of any further type PPO or preferred providers or point of service type of mechanism to lower overall health care costs. And the small employer and the individual who's going to be affected by this, not the ERISA groups, are going to end up ultimately opting out of any dental coverage because of it. I mean, I think that's the economics argument.
That's a point on which we continue to disagree.
Right. Representative Murkowski.
Can I have a clarification, please, as to what a point of service option exactly is, and what, after you've told me what they are, do we have them here?
Mrs. Burke.
My name is Marcy Burke, and I'm with Providence Health System.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ms. Burton, go ahead, if you will.
I can help answer that question if you'd
sure.
like. We do have point of service options in this state, and let me describe what it is, and then I'll give you an example of what it is. A point of service option is a similar animal to a preferred provider organization, but it does much like what we've been talking about here. It allows a patient to go outside of a negotiated network to see a provider of their choice. There is a differential in the coverage that the plan or the employer provides. My experience has shown that those differentials typically range from 10 to 20%, but there can often be an additional copayment tacked onto that. An example of a point of service option is one that we offer our employees. It's a coordinated care plan, and we have a negotiated network of primary care providers, which are typically your general medical physicians. And as long as the patient is seeing one of those physicians or getting referrals from those physicians, they have benefit coverage of 80%. If they choose to go to another provider, though, without a referral or just going on their own, they may do so. Coverage is at 60%. Let me give you an example of also what could happen if you don't have a significant size of a network. In our network, we only have primary care physicians. We were not able to negotiate a discounted rate with specialty physicians. And so, therefore, we were unable to provide an adequately sized network for our patients to use. Thus, we ended up opening it up to all of the providers. Therefore, you do need to have a network that is large enough to serve a group in order to be effective. I've given you more information than just defining a point of service plan, but let me know if I have not defined it well enough.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Burton. Representative Murkowski.
Well, you've helped with that, but I understand that if you have a preferred provider set up, you can also opt to go outside of the list of preferred providers, providing that you are willing to make up the difference. Is that not correct?
That can be correct. Coverage can vary quite a bit among the different plans.
If I might, it depends on how the plan is structured. If you have many times you could prohibit the stepping out of the panel on the PPO, whereas if you specifically provide for point of service in the plan, that choice option is there at the beginning.
And if the plan specifically provides that you cannot go outside the panel of the PPO, and you do so at 100%.
I believe that's correct. Maybe Ms. Burke could. Marianne, could you join us at the table? Con, just stay there.
Okay.
Is that distinction between the PPO and the POS valid? Are we on the right track here?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Mary Ann Burke, and I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance, and I have to apologize to the representative. I missed part of her comment, and may I ask that she...
She was asking for the distinction between a PPO and a POS, and could you not step out of a PPO, and if you did, you'd get zero reimbursement? Is that correct?
I'm not aware of any arrangement that would provide zero, but I am aware of significantly less reimbursement. Basically, a point of service was described absolutely accurately to you. A PPO, as we have discussed it, and with the chair's permission, I try to get this, all of the various testimonies synthesized. If we assume it's a $100 procedure, the old system that we know, which is known as an indemnity system, you went to the dentist, your plan paid for 80%, and you paid for 20%. Thus, the dentist got $100. Under a preferred provider arrangement, you can use the preferred provider, and you always have the right to go to another dentist. If you go to the preferred provider, that dentist has agreed to accept less than $100 for the procedure in exchange for being on this list of preferred providers. The dentist will get $70 from the insurance company, and the patient will pay $20. They're getting $90 instead of $100. So the dentist gets $90. If the patient in the preferred provider arrangement goes out of network, and that's the term that's used, the dentist is going to get $100. But the insurance company will only pay 50 or 60% of that, and the patient picks up the remainder. Thus, there is, as has been testified, a disincentive to the patient to go out of network. But the bottom line from the dentist's point of view is they still get $100 if they're out of network, but they get less if they are a preferred provider in exchange for the referrals. Disincentive to the patient is there.
I think we've clarified PPO, but now...
The PPO, a point of service option is usually associated with an HMO. And again, since we have no HMOs in this state, but it basically you select the provider, the practitioner that you want, and that person becomes your, if you will, preferred provider.
I would suggest, Ms. Burke, that what we might look at is a point of service option within any kind of a PPO plan or any insured plan written in the state that, you know, would provide that choice with whatever differential that may be statutorily stipulated to at least create some modicum of spread. So there's the disincentive to the patient still there, but the impact to the physicians or the doctor, to the dentist, would be minimized. I mean, that's something I'm thinking about now.
Mr. Chairman, I think your legal advice is right on point here. Unless there is an incentive for the
insurer.
The insurer or the employer or whomever decides to set up this preferred provider arrangement, the incentive being overall it will cost them less money, therefore they can lower the premiums and get people to buy their product.
Right.
Unless that incentive is there, you will not have any PPOs forming.
very good. Dr. Hipscher, just again, your testimony is that you would not be happy with some type of point of service provision in statute that would have to be mandated for a PPO up here. Is that correct? Doctor, are you there?
Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
No, I can't answer. Did you hear my question?
Yes, I did. The assumption that we're making here is that all employers have to purchase dental insurance, and that is absolutely not correct.
Right.
There are other options available to employers. But, you know, we need to disassociate dentistry from medicine because they are two totally different animals. And, you know, we're boiling this HB 121 down to a matter of cost. And if it's a matter of cost, employers need to look at other avenues to save money and still provide their patients with dental care. Now, what you're talking about in terms of medicine definitely applies, but in dentistry, it doesn't necessarily apply because there are other alternatives because dentistry does not meet the need of an insured situation.
And what would those alternatives be?
One is going into an ERISA plan where the employers can manage a direct reimbursement plan. And, you know, we have lots and lots of data to show that employers can save a lot of money. You know, some employers back east are saving as much as 50% over their insured dental plans by going to direct reimbursement plans.
Well, how do they save the money?
Well, they're only paying for the care that actually gets rendered. You know, right now there's probably only one out of every two people that actually go to a dentist. And even the people that go to the dentist, you know, many people are in a mode where they're just getting cleanings and checkups once a year. So their utilization rate is very low.
Well, you're talking about basically fee-for-service inside of an ERISA, you pay as you go basis like a self-insured. I mean,
that is exactly true.
Rather than a premium, that's all. Right?
Rather than paying a premium.
Well, that's
because dentistry does not meet the need for an insured risk. I mean, employers, we know year after year how much money people need to spend at the dentist because there are a number of people that are in a routine care situation where they're just seeing us for a cleaning and an exam.
Doctor, the majority of people in the state that are non-ERISA don't have that choice, and that's the issue. Those are the only people this bill affects. Do you understand that?
I do.
So we're a very limited amount of individuals and small employer groups that are going to be affected by this legislation.
All I'm saying, Mr. Chairman, is that the employers have not opened their eyes because the insurance people have, you know, they're not telling them the full story about all of this stuff. We're seeing a nationwide movement towards, you know, in dentistry towards direct reimbursement plans because employers are seeing that they can save a lot of money and still offer their patients, you know, excellent care.
So the local pizza parlor owner should come to you and cut a deal with you to send all of his employees to you?
No. That's not the situation. They can still go to any dentist they want, but the pizza parlor only pays for the treatment that gets rendered. And they may only pay a percentage of that treatment. You know, there are a multitude of plans that can be designed.
Okay.
All I'm saying is that employers need to look at the alternatives.
So who needs an insurer when they can do direct reimbursement? Is that what you're saying?
Say again, I'm sorry?
Yeah, who needs an insurer, a middleman, in paying a premium when you can go to direct reimbursement? So that's, okay, I think I understand.
For dentistry, that is exactly true. Right. For dentistry and vision.
Quite frankly, with the premium schedules I've seen with the caps of $1,500, it might be the way to go.
Well, it is. You know, I advise a lot of people year after year to get out of their insurance plan and just pay their dentistry as they go. They would save a lot of money.
Okay. Further questions of Dr. Hipscher? Does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 121? Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 121? Hearing none, I'd like to close the public hearing with options today. There are have been distributed some amendments, and let's see. On your table is amendment by Representative Halko. It's page 2, line 14. I'd like to mark that as amendment number 1. And there's Representative Halko, you're on the sunset. You're not going to.
No, I'm going to withdraw that amendment.
The sunset one is withdrawn. And I'm going to withdraw my amendment with the understanding that before we take up these amendments, I'm withdrawing my amendment in light of which would have withdrawn sections 3-1. My preference in some of the questioning is that I'd like to see a point of service option with a fee minimum, for example, no less than 10 or 20% differential, but still have some differential. That's, I think, one way to go about doing this, so we can still incentivize the creation of PPOs, but on the other hand, make sure that the dental professional is properly, or at least partially reimbursed for their procedures, and minimize the effect on their patients. Another way to approach it is keeping in mind the goal of the committee, and would be to make available insurance, dental plans available to small business and individuals, not ERISA. The other way to do it is Representative Halko's idea here, and with that, Representative Halko, I will give you the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move Amendment 1 for a number of reasons. Mr. Chair, 86%.
Are there objections? Object for purposes of discussion. Representative Kowski. Thank you very much. Representative Halko.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The intent of this bill, as we've heard from the sponsor, and as a matter of fact, Dr. Hipcher just, when asked the question about cost being passed along to employers, this is supposed to be a cost-neutral bill. It's not supposed to cost employers any additional monies. And that is the concern. Mr. Chair, 86% of the businesses in Alaska, according to the Department of Labor, employ less than 20 people, and those are the people that I believe that we need to make sure that employers can afford good health care. I totally support the intent and the concept of House Bill 121. I took it upon myself to call 4 or 5 dentists in my district and talked at length to them about this bill. I personally get very nervous when government starts dabbling in health care. With having said that, as like I have mentioned previously, the sponsor has said it wouldn't cost businesses any more. Dr. Hipcher, to quote him, said absolutely not when asked would it increase the cost for of health care for employers. And so I would simply say, let's put this in writing then. If it's not going to cost employers any additional money, let's put it in the statute. There is current provisions in state and federal statutes with regard to mental health coverage that allow employers to opt out if they can prove a 1% increase in the total cost of providing the service. I've been a little more liberal. I've given 2%. I think that's fair. I think the intent, obviously, is to make sure that health care is available to all workers in the state of Alaska. But it's something the employer has to afford. And I don't think that government should be dictating the terms and conditions without giving some kind of provision to protect small businesses. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would move amendment number 1.
Thank you very much for us. Mrs. Burke, could you come forward again, please? And for the record, For the record?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Mary Ann Burke, and I am the Director of the Division of Insurance.
Have you had a chance to look at Amendment Number 1?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have.
Does the implementation of like this, how would this actually work as a practical matter in relationship to your department? Is there an enforcement judgment rule? Who makes the decision?
Mr. Chairman, they would have to provide, the individual employer would have to provide documentation that their costs were increasing. And that would be through the premiums they are paying. On the insurer side, it would have to be documentation that the individual plan that is offered in this state is the costs are increasing. The problem with that documentation is there are a number of factors that could be impacting it at the same time: increased utilization, a spike in unusual care might cause the cost to go up, and it would not be just a function of not being able to have a preferred provider. Whenever we try to quantify that, we can't isolate a single occurrence and say X number of dollars is a result of this.
Well, to follow up, are you saying that is this doable or not doable, and would your department incur any kind of fiscal cost in refereeing these decisions?
Mr. Chairman, the Division of Insurance would incur additional effort and cost to oversee this, because it would require us to invest additional staff time in computing the increases, verifying the data that was submitted to us.
Representative Murkowski and Bundy.
I was going to ask you a question, okay, whether or not it is practical and doable.
Representative Bundy.
Mr. Chairman, I admit that my view of insurance companies is highly skewed, perhaps they'd say, by Mr. Grisham and other people who write so accurately of their behavior, and that, you know, this is an outfit that's in the business of making money, not providing health care. And knowing major corporations and the volume of accountants and tax lawyers and other ne'er-do-wells that they can employ, it wouldn't be very difficult for someone who was inclined to be uncooperative to show a 2% bump, I think. I'm a little concerned that we're getting the fox guarding the hen house there, that they'd say, well, we'll fix this, we'll just raise our premiums 2% and everybody's going to opt out, and we've killed it through the back door.
Questions? Representative Howcroft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Burke, when you testified on Friday and said basically the law in and of itself, some of the provisions in HB 121 were mandating things that were already covered, that your department was already doing, or things that were already set in statute. And when we talked about what is driving this House bill, where's the problem? I mean, this is a cure. Where's the problem? There was no problem. I forget what the terminology was. Preventative. Pardon the pun. This was a preventative bill. So, I'm not quite sure I understand where the fiscal note would come in, because if there isn't currently a problem, how do you know what the fiscal note is going to be and how much work it's going to entail?
Through the chair, right now I couldn't quantify for it, but this would be Amendment Number 1 would be mandating additional data be checked and verified to see if there had been an increase as a result of this particular legislation. As statutes currently exist, we verify data in the aggregate that is sent in to support an increase in premium. if an insurance company says they should raise their rates 5%, then they must demonstrate to us in the aggregate that is justified. They do not, at this time, break that increase down to the various components, such as increased utilization, change in statutes, change in mandates, etc. And I would share Representative Bundy's skepticism about the industry I regulate. They are creative.
You're much kinder. Yes.
They would not hesitate to come in with a 2% increase, but they would have to verify it to us. And if they said it was a result of this particular legislation, they would have to prove that to us. And there is where the additional work on our part would come in. And as I said, I can't give you dollars right now because this is something that will require research.
Thank you.
Well, on that point, I've been looking at Mr. Evans is conspicuous by his absence today, but perhaps you would know the annual adjustments in health insurance premiums are on an annualized basis. Do you happen to kind of give us a ballpark of what they're doing?
Mr. Chairman, I can tell you that for individual policies in the state of Alaska, there is a 16% increase in utilization between 1997 and 1998. And that is actual utilization, going to doctors and incurring fees. For small groups, and by small groups I mean 2 to 50 as defined in our statutes as a small group, there was an increase of approximately 22% in utilization. That translates into a 17% increase in individual rates. The 1% is again tied to our premium tax as well as the addition. If you have more claims, you have more overhead. A portion of that 1% is to cover the increase in claims. Large groups, I don't know, because the large groups are individually negotiated with employers and can vary dramatically depending upon what the plan covers.
Further questions? Follow up on my question. You don't know what a trend would be over, let's say, the last 5 or 10 years about annual premium increases?
Mr. Chairman, the trend has been up, and if you trended it using an actuarial term over time, we have about a 15 to 20% increase.
Per annum?
Per annum.
Well, those are per annum figures when you said 17. That was an annual?
Yes, Mr. Chairman,
over, what,
that is true.
5 or 10 years? Well, this would generate some type of a fiscal note, which would be an indeterminate fiscal note, or you have to look at this.
Mr. Chairman, we could come up with an estimate, but I would certainly not give you a number off the top of my head.
And I'm concerned that if there's a 15% trend line in annual premiums, I mean, that seems to be extraordinarily more than a 2% increase in cost. So the 2% figure doesn't seem to be a valid figure to use given those circumstances. Representative Outcroft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But given the testimony we've heard over the last 2 days, the overwhelming common thread that we've heard is that dentistry is not overutilized. I mean, people go to the dentist when they absolutely have to. But if I'm understanding you correctly, the premiums and the rise, the adjustment in the premiums, it's not broken down into dental health. It's not. It's just total cost. Is that correct?
Through the chair, the package, the policy is priced as a total. There are breakdowns by policies that do not include a dental option, and some policies do not. The testimony that there isn't overutilization of dentistry, I would say, based on our experience, is a valid observation. Preventive dentistry, as we know it, is pretty flat-lined. However, even in dentistry, you do have unanticipated extraordinary costs. Periodontal diseases, or anyone who's paid for crown knows that they're extremely expensive, and that can cause quite an increase in the cost of dentistry for a particular employer.
Well, I have a concern about the percentage here myself. I don't know. I'm going to help you. Do you want to speak to your amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair, the intent, obviously, as I outlined, is to protect, you know, those small businesses that provide health care coverage for their employers, or their employees, excuse me. And I don't want some unintended consequences, as we've seen in other legislation. The thought behind forwarding this amendment is simply to put the assertion that this isn't going to raise the cost of coverage for employers into the statute. And I agree with you. Obviously, you can't put a fiscal note on something you don't have. Part of my concern is this is preventative. There's not a problem now. There may not be a problem in 3 or 4 years. This provision may never kick in because we may never have this kind of a situation. But then again, it may.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, one way that possibly this could be quantified, if you think in terms of a PPO arrangement, will provide the services for 10% or 20% less than the market value, if you will. $80 instead of $100 or whatever. If an employer was not able to have that type of arrangement and we went to pure indemnity, that would increase the cost in that range.
Or if the panel, if the fee differential reimbursement was leveled by this bill, then they may just are paying a premium, and that's where the percentage would come about, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And then you could make a calculation where you would discount any overall inflation before you had the differential. Representative Bundy.
Well, at the risk of following in the chairman's footsteps and amending my own bill, I'm sharing Representative Hal Croth, and I suspect all of you are concerned about unintended consequences, and that would not be my intention, obviously. If you were to substitute the amendment you withdrew for this amendment, would that alleviate your concerns about unintended consequences?
Representative Hal Croth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point. The 2% increase, it only applies to the effect of this legislation, not to overall premiums. I mean, the 2% increase would have to be because of this legislation affected. But just to clarify once again, there's no way to discern that. There's no way to break that out. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, again, because there are a number of variables all acting at the same time, we could make educated guesses, but I could not say to you definitively that as a result of this, it was an increase of X number of dollars or percentage.
Well, with that, Mr. Chair, I definitely didn't want to incur a fiscal note. I did think it was very important to bring up the fact that concern with whenever government gets involved in dictating or mandating healthcare rules or coverages, The cost is usually borne by the employer. And with a significant amount of Alaskan businesses, small employers, I think it's we're well served to protect those interests. I would withdraw my amendment, amendment number one. And just to follow up Representative Bundy, the sunset clause is, which I had put out 5 years, I might see where that is. Representative Bundy and I, for the record, had spoken about this earlier, about a possible sunset clause. I can see that if that is our last line of defense, then I would, with the chair's permission, like to reintroduce Amendment 2.
No, it's not. I'm a really out of order.
Okay.
Because I'm the chairman. I have a conceptual amendment. I just like to move a conceptual amendment, which would be on page 2, line 9. After dentist, and it would read something to the effect that except for point of service options, which may reimburse dentists at a discount not to exceed 10%. I don't think the words are artful, but I think they have the elements with which the drafter can work, which would allow a point of service option within a PPO or with any type of a insured plan offered, and the intention of the reimbursement is of 10% is the differential that can be discounted if you go outside the panel. Does everybody understand what the amendment is?
No.
No.
Okay. Ms. Burke, you're shaking your head no to?
Mr. Chairman, would that 10% apply to the copay, to the amount the dentist
Oh, yes, the copay or the direct or indirect reimbursement. That's probably what it should, because the term direct or indirect reimbursement I take to mean either direct reimbursement or a copayment. So that's a good point. I mean, it would be the direct or indirect reimbursement to a covered person. That's what it should read, to the covered person. It'd be discounted. What I'm trying to do is get a differential not to exceed 10%. It's a very small differential, but it's enough to maybe save some of those organizations and keep them going.
Could you read it again, Mr. Chair?
Well, it's except for point of service options, which may directly or indirectly reimburse a covered person at a rate differential of not to exceed 10%. It's conceptual in nature, and we'll leave it to the drafter to get that. In other words, you could represent by me.
If I might use my analogy just to make sure that my previous analogies that I understand where you're going. Someone within the program has a procedure that costs $100 to get reimbursed at $80. They choose to go outside the program. The dentist gets reimbursed at $70. You know, round numbers.
That's be $72.
Yeah, and plus the patient would still be responsible for the additional copayment to make
right.
The outside dentist.
It'd be
well, $100
penalty
procedure.
The penalty would be less when you stepped outside the network.
Up to 10%.
Right, that's right. Or, you know, you could make it 15 or 20, but now it seems typically it's about 20. If it's 80 to step out 60, that'd be a 20%. Or 20, actually 25%.
You want to limit it to 10%.
No. It might make the sponsor happier, but, I mean, that's kind of an arguable thing. What's the magic number? I'd like it a little higher.
Insurance companies would say zero.
Are you saying higher, Patty?
Well, they would say there would be zero reimbursement.
So yes.
And dentists should say there would be 100%. So, yeah, I guess 90% is a compromise.
Yeah, or 10%.
Or it's half of what is
Well, it's against whatever they're paying. If they're paying 80%, then it's right 10% less than what the 80% was. So.
72%.
We have enough information here with sites to be able to get a draft that the committee can understand. Mm-hmm. Does everybody on the committee understand what I'm trying to get at? I think this is a representative.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, that's something I can live with.
I appreciate that because I think it's important to avoid the appearance even that we're going to be creating legislation that creates a disincentive that ultimately may cost people coverage, and we don't want to do that. And maybe we'll toy with the percentage later on down the stream here as the bill moves its way through the process. But I think it is a compromise that hopefully will not be too objectionable to the people with the bill. Are there any objections to the conceptual amendment? Seeing none, so moved. That concludes the bill. We will now take up a chair orientation to obtain a motion on House Bill 121 as amended with the attached zero fiscal note. Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill number 121 with the conceptual amendment and attached zero fiscal note with individual recommendations.
Are there any objections?
Yes.
Or two attached.
There's one from insurance and one from medical.
Staff indicates two fiscal notes. Any objections?
Yes.
Objections? Paula. No objection. We'll take a roll call vote.
Chairman Roper?
Yes.
Representative Bryce?
No.
Representative Cisna?
No.
Representative Sanders?
No.
Representative Harris?
No.
Representative McCaskey? Yes. Representative Halford?
No.
Please.
The total is 2 yay, 5 nay.
The motion fails 5-2. Therefore, we will move on with the calendar. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you.
Next, we'd like to take up very quickly House Bill 143 because we are running out of time. I don't know that you folks want to get out of here. There is an hour. We have a few people on board. We lost two in Kino. Well, okay. And yeah. No, you got to have a majority. Motion failed. Yeah, you guys just killed it.
Yeah, but
you can step on it with your foot and put a lance in it.
I'm having a meeting tomorrow. We're going
to
finalize.
Unless the committee wants to rescind the sanction, which under the circumstances looks highly unlikely. We're at ease. Take go back to order. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I take up House Bill 143. We're quick to take the public testimony for the people that have the good patience and so forth to show up. We did lose two gentlemen, Mr. Speaker and Mr. Johnson, and Kenai, unfortunately. And I will very briefly describe this bill, which I have introduced myself. This is an act that, this bill is in two sections. Number one, it affects the surety fund of the Alaska Real Estate Commission. And then it goes on to provide for provisions of non-disclosure of psychological impairment to property. The first part of the bill changes the use of the
portion of the surety fund. The surety fund under existing law is established doesn't exceed $500,000 in contributions, which are part of a fee paid by real estate licensees, not to exceed $125 a biennial, that is used in lieu of a bond to, after procedural hearings and claims are made, can be awarded up to $10,000 per incident out of the surety fund. So it's a consumer protection in lieu of bond type fund. It was established a number of years ago. But in the real estate statute as it exists currently, there are allowances to use portions of the surety fund above $250,000 for educational purposes. And what's occurred is that the commission has funded portions of personnel services, including the executive secretary, I believe, of the commission, and another full-time position. The executive secretary has got a portion of her, I believe, salary is paid, and then the other position, which is the number two position in the office, and the only other person in the office in Anchorage, is, I believe, almost fully paid, if not out of the fund, as well as the sponsoring of certain classes, seminars, and other things that may be approved by the commission itself. But what's happened is you're all hopefully aware now, particularly newcomers, Alaska statute requires that each occupational license pay its own freight. But the real estate licensees are kind of unusual because they have their biennial license fee, and then they also have the surety fund fee, which is all well and good, except the way the use of the funds is, it, to me, it commingles what should be entirely the license fee in with the surety fund fee, because they're actually using operational expenses. They're removing monies from the surety fund for what I would consider operational expenses. So it's the intent of this bill, the first part of the bill, to change that and make the biennial licensing fee cover all the expenses of the commission in the licensing fee, as every other license is done, and only remove from the surety fund that amount which is for the administration and servicing of the surety fund. That is to say, hearing officers, attorneys, all the other expenses and the claims that come out of the surety fund. Therefore, when the biennial cycle comes around, if there is very little use of the surety fund, which in the last couple of years there actually has been very little use, and now the law allows for lapsing into the GF, the general fund, when you get over $500,000 in the thing. But we put sweep language in the budget so it doesn't happen, so it's kind of a ruse. That's what I'm trying to do, is straighten this thing out. So what we're doing is only having the fees paid by the fund, or into the fund, for the fund, and run the fund operations out of the fund, and have all the other licensing costs in their fee. That's the intention. Representative Rice, go on.
Now, the sweeping of all the various funds, that's not a constitutional requirement?
No. It's actually in the statute here, and what we're doing is changing that, too. So there's a like a ongoing report, so we know we don't get over that a cap anymore, so we run into that problem. That's in the bill, too. There's a little section in there. But that's basically the intent of that. Because I want you to know there's been some accusations, whether they're fair or not, and Ms. Reardon knows about these, that the people on the commission have been using the surety fund as a slush fund to go take trips to Hawaii and stuff like that. It just so happened as that one of the members of the executive staff of the commission did go to what's called an ARILO, or a National Real Estate Officers Convention, that happened to be in Hawaii a couple of years ago. I think it was an absolutely legitimate expense, but it has this specter. So that kind of tripped off this thing. Plus, we always have to be aware, particularly of the administrations in the Department of Commerce and Economic Development, OCC licensing. Well, it's actually the commissioner's office is always tapping into the licensing fees that Ms. Rudin has to defend against, right? She's the great defender of this, but there's always that problem, too. And then there's another little twister here. The Real Estate Commission has been publishing the landlord-tenant law book for several years. And for the life of me, I can't figure out why. It's like a phantom tax on light real estate licensees. I mean, I think we have a responsibility as a state to publish a landlord-tenant book, no question about it.
How much
why,
is
it? It's about $6,000 a year, every other year. But for the life of me, you've got to tell me why the real estate licensees are paying for it out of their fees. I mean, is there some social responsibility tax penalty there? That's not right.
Well, you could pay for that. We'll just take it out of your per diem, Mr.
That's right. Okay, I'm not per diem. Anyway, that's the first part of the bill. And the second part of the bill has to do with psychological impairment. There's a very large number of states that have these provisions of statute, and I kind of looked at this bill, so I don't know what it says here. This takes away any obligation on part of a real estate licensee to disclose certain background information about a property. And that's including a natural death, a suicide, a murder, or other crime classified as a felony under state or federal law on the property. In other words, if you have a house listing, you should not have to disclose, and you should all know, we have a disclosure form. Anytime a residential property is sold, there is a mandate in the statute that requires that the disclosure form be filled out, and there are certain requirements for disclosure. What's happened is there's national case law about the expectations of what should or should not be disclosed. There's even a case in Massachusetts where the failure to disclose a ghost, repeating that, the failure to disclose the existence of a ghost in a residential home was grounds for rescission of a contract.
You don't believe in ghosts?
She sold her house, but didn't
say it. Well, some people find it incredible. Other people think it's very normal, but I mean...
Where was his hat? You should have told us.
At ease.
He said at ease, but...
Oh, no. It should be at ease. Okay. I rule Senator Murkowski's... Reginald Murkowski's...
I know. I've
known your dad too long. It's a late day. Representative Murkowski, you're out of order.
Thank you, sir.
But you will use your ghost example on the floor. Anyway, no.
No, I don't want it disclosed that I didn't disclose it.
Oh. That's right.
That's precisely the point of this bill. The other thing is that
sold.
The real property, recent transaction. Figure out the record.
An old saying down here, if you don't want something brought up, don't bring it up.
Yeah. Lock the lip. The real property, there's certain background information that shouldn't be disclosed. For example, the AIDS or HIV positive disease, because it's unlikely to be transmitted. This particular provision in the law reflects the federal law, which is on the books now. But it's just a further reminder, remembering the licensees have to learn their law, to remind them that's part of federal law, and they shouldn't do that. And the other thing is, subsection D on page 3, an amendment I rather intemperately, without committee hearings, put in a real estate bill last year that relieves the obligation of a real estate licensee to disclose a registered sex offender in the property. You gentlemen there have had some veterans here where we call that situation.
This is what I was looking for.
Yes. This is a famous provision. And what I want to do is get the feedback from the real estate industry and see how they want to proceed on these particular issues. The first section, I think, is an important thing that should be taken care of. The second one is a personal vendetta. Excuse me, a personal... something I want to try to get cleaned up. Representative Bryce.
Two questions, Mr. Chair. If we're removing the landlord-tenant printing out of the Real Estate Commission, I think it's appropriate to put it someplace else. That would still be, you'd go from there, take it for what it's worth. And then I think there is going to be an issue with removing the removing the notification requirements on sex offenders.
I have to educate you guys.
I was here when we passed the law to make it to register sex offenders, and it was a bill that I supported.
Well, this has nothing to do with the sex offender registry.
Well, yes, it does. It has to do specifically with.
Well, we have taken care of a good part of the disclosure, but we haven't taken care of the potential liability on a licensee.
And Mr. Chair, just from personal experience, I bought a house this December, and they gave me this piece of paper that says we're not going to do this search, but if you want to do this search, please be our guest. Here's the homepage you need to go visit. I appreciated that very much.
That's what the bill provided for.
No, this takes out that.
No, that's what the prior bill did.
That's right.
This is the closure. This is the last step in that. Representative Hopper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me ask you about